Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report Under Lockdown. It's a Tuesday. Do you know what that means? On the show, joining us once again, Jordan Ewell is here. How's it going, Jordan?
John, it's going well. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. The last time you were here, by the way, I just want to do a quick plug for this. It's no big deal. Everyone calm down. But the last time you were here, you previewed that we were going to be doing, I was going to be participating in your awesome Fortnite charity stream, which since happened, and you hosted it for what seemed like two full days you were playing. And it was a huge success, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like 30 hours of Fortnite. I took a break to sleep, which I think was a good idea in retrospect. But yeah, we played for 30 hours. We went in with a goal of raising $5,000 for Healthcare for the Homeless, an organization in Baltimore. And we ended up raising over $7,000. So yeah, definitely successful. Had a lot of fun. And thank you for playing. We got a win, by the way. You, Brett, and me.
Oh, I was going to mention that. Don't worry.
Okay. All right.
No, but that's crazy. I mean, you raised a ton of money. I saw... AOC did like an impromptu Instagram live stream where she was trying to raise money for a cause, and she raised like 17,000, but she's AOC. You raised like half an AOC. That's pretty amazing for anyone who's not AOC. And that's, so it was awesome to see that. And everybody had a ton of fun. As you said, we got a win, and, I've since learned that you win at that game a lot, but I don't. So, but do you know what happened? So we played and we got our one win. And after that, at some point within the last week, I played again. Myself and Brett and Brett's wife squatted up and we won twice more. So I think it's rubbed off and I think I'm ready to go pro. Ninja, here I come. He probably doesn't even play anymore. What does he play? I don't know. Probably.
I think he does. I think he still plays.
Oh, he
still
does? Plays. Okay. Yeah. Do you think he likes it? I wonder. Anyway, you know what I don't like? The news, and that's what we've got for you today. So Jordan and I are going to be breaking down a bunch of stories as we go through this hour. We're going to be starting off catching up just a little bit with the presidential coronavirus briefing yesterday, and then moving right into what is currently ongoing. I believe it's still happening, is a number of different health officials are testifying before the Senate right now about the coronavirus response. We've got updates on the spread of coronavirus amongst those doing the anti-lockdown protests, and what the hell is going on with Elon Musk. We're gonna try to figure that out. And if you're already watching, feel free to hit the like button. Would be great. Help spread the stream. Let more people know about the show going on. You can send us comments and tweets at hashtag TDR Live, super chats, and you can also comment along on Twitch. And we've got people watching all of those. So Jordan and I can respond to the comments that you send in. Looks like a bunch are coming in right now. I will read one. Is it already in there? Mark Robertson says, can we get a look at one of Jordan's guitars at 1,000 likes?
Sure. Yeah. Awesome. If you're fine with it. Yeah.
So as an alternative to the traditional like dog or cat. Exactly. Maybe we'll see. I was going to say like a cool slang term for guitar, but honestly, I don't even know what they're called. What do you call them?
I mean, you can call it a lot of different things. I guess a term that they might like is like axe or something like that.
There you go. That's sort of, I was thinking of hammer, but that's not right. Anyway, there you go. I knew it was something traditionally wielded by dwarves. Okay. So 1,000 likes, and maybe we'll get an axe for you. I'd like to see it because I just watched Fury Road over the weekend, and that Doof Warrior with his, that was cool.
Oh, so that spits out the like the napalm or the fire.
Exactly. I'm looking to see more of that. Anyway, with that, why don't we jump into the news, Jordan? Yesterday, Donald Trump held one of his coronavirus press briefings, and sort of the big headline of the day was that Trump effectively declared mission accomplished over this entire thing. The particular quote that I loved, and they did briefly, they had tweeted it out and then eventually took the tweet down, had a video of him saying, we have met the moment and we have prevailed. Jordan, have we met the moment and or have we prevailed?
John, I would say no. I would say it's it's a bit premature. When we're months, if not years, away from a vaccine completely eradicating this virus. And it's hard to resist the comparisons to Bush's mission accomplished moment. You know, they rushed out. It was way premature. They wanted to claim victory, get the positive PR, because, you know, there's a couple different factors here at play. I mean, people are starting to suffer. People are falling behind on bills and rent. My cat is crawling on my back right now. And
we're suffering in a variety of ways.
Yeah, right. And Trump's in an election year. So he has a ton of incentives to try to expedite the eradication of this virus and get things back to normal, reopen businesses, continue to boost the economy, things like that. So, you know, it was tempting, and they took the bait to go out there and say, yeah, we did it. We met the moment, when in reality, we're still months, if not years away from this thing ending.
Exactly. I agree. The comparisons are fairly obvious. It seems insane to declare victory knowing that 1,000 people will die the day you claim victory, and God only knows how many will die in the following days. But he does have one thing going for him, and that is that the people that like him will do and say and believe whatever he wants them to. And they fully agree. Yeah, no, we've prevailed. I don't care how many people have died. I don't believe how many people have died. Trump's right. We're done with this. It's all just fear-mongering. Let's move on. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, they seem more determined to blame this on China shift the focus onto another country and their handling of it, or the blame for the origin or things like that, than, you know, talking about the need for ventilators, the need for tests, things like that, the need for social distancing. So it's a completely warped response to a global crisis. And yeah, again, it was just super premature to do this.
You know, it's funny that you mention shifting the blame to another country, because we're going to turn now to how the press briefing ended. And it ended abruptly, as you'll see. Take a look at the last minute. Take a look at what sent Donald Trump fleeing from the podium.
That the U.S. is doing far better than any other country when it comes to testing.
Yes.
Why does that matter? Why is this a global competition to you if every day Americans are still losing their lives and we're still seeing more cases every day?
Well, they're losing their lives everywhere in the world. And maybe that's a question you should ask China. Don't ask me. Ask China that question, okay? When you ask them that question, you may get a very unusual answer. Yes, behind you, please.
What, sir, why are you saying that to me specifically?
I'm telling you. I'm not saying it specifically to anybody. I'm saying it to anybody that would ask a nasty question
That's
like that.
That's not a nasty question.
Please go ahead.
Why does it matter?
Okay. Anybody else? Please, go ahead in the back, please.
I have two questions.
No, it's okay.
But we'll you pointed to me. I have two questions, Mr.
Next.
President.
Next, please.
But you called on me.
I did, and you didn't respond, and now I'm calling on...
Sorry, I just
the young lady in the back, please.
I just wanted to let my colleague finish, okay. But can I ask you
ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the alpha male in his natural habitat. They're being mean to me. I don't want them to be mean to me anymore. I'm out of here. It wasn't supposed to end. He was just supposed to keep taking questions. But because those women didn't stop talking when he wanted them desperately to stop talking, he just left. He walked away.
Yeah. I mean, this is routine behavior for him. We've seen, I've talked about this with you on the show a few weeks ago. You meet Michelle Alexander from PBS. She'll just ask him a straightforward news question, and he'll like just go off on a tirade and attack her. We see this time and time again with women and reporters of color, specifically women of color. He feels like threatened or intimidated. And I think there's also there's internalized misogyny and internalized racism within him that he projects onto them and their questions. This is just a pretty embarrassing moment if anyone was in that situation, let alone the president of the United States. And it's straightforward question. And the fact that he responded in such a way and then stormed off is just truly embarrassing.
Yeah, embarrassing in so many ways. A lot of men, and I would say that I think it's safe to say they're overrepresented amongst conservative men. I think it's one of the chief things that makes a man into a conservative man is that they have only a couple of different settings for their view of women. It's lusting after women, being terrified of them, likely because you think they're going to reject you, or being enraged at them. Those are the different settings you can be on, and that's basically it. The incel mentality doesn't require that you're not having sex. Donald Trump has a wife, still very much has that mentality. That's how he sees women. And you see that on display, as you said, over and over. They ask nasty questions. What does that mean? I don't know, but I do know that it's a question that a woman has asked. That's what makes something nasty, is that she didn't back down. And when he says, why don't you ask China? we all know exactly why he said that and why he said that in particular to her. It's now the duty of conservatives to pretend that they don't understand that. That's what they'll do. Denying racism is the main job of a conservative grifter these days, and probably always. But anyway, his turn to blaming China is also part of a narrative that we've seen. I will say that I was watching this Joe Biden ad recently, I think it was yesterday, about Trump's statements denying that coronavirus is going to be serious and things like that. And I didn't like the ad because the ad also is very much fear-mongering and trying to cast blame onto China. But the thing is, we know that for the first month or so, Trump was, he was complimenting China on the way that they were working with us, what they were doing to fight the disease. It's very well documented in his public statements. But now he needs a scapegoat. And after watching like a month of, you know, Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham talking about Wuhan flu and stuff like that, he apparently decided, yeah, no, they've primed the audience to hate Asian people. So I'm just going to go with that. I'm going to say it's China's fault. Forget everything else that I said. My base certainly will. It's all on them. The question is going to be, is that going to work? Are enough of the American people going to think it doesn't matter that Trump didn't take this seriously and didn't do what's necessary to stop people from dying? Something, something, China.
Yeah, I mean, this, I don't know, there's so many ways to kind of frame this. I think one thing to remember is that, you know, we had 17 White House staffers embedded in the WHO at the very onset of this thing. And they were getting reports as it started to emerge in China and were reporting back to the White House in real time with information about this, warning Trump administration officials about this. So to act like this was, you know, China's doing, and then China kept everyone in the dark is completely ahistorical. We know this to be fact because, I mean, that's, you know, they were staffed and it's been reported out. So there's a few different, you know, you could call it xenophobic, you can call it racist, but underlying all of that is a lack of preparedness and a sheer inability to govern. And what the Trump administration is doing is just trying to shift the blame to, you know, distract people from their own ineptitude. Again, like we talked about earlier, it's an election year for Trump. This is going to be, you know, there's no way around this is going to be a bad circumstance. It's going to hurt anybody, Democrat or Republican. But Trump is so obsessed with retaining power and maintaining control that this is one thing. They're willing to go like a step too far in a way that other politicians might not, mm-hmm. To shift the blame and deflect from their own failures.
I do believe that Trump has seen some of the criticism. I'm assuming he went straight from the podium to a TV to watch how people were covering his hasty retreat. And he had this to say to people saying that this seems to be an indication of his continued racism and xenophobia towards Asian Americans. He tweeted, "Asian Americans are very angry at what China has done to our capital country and the capital world. Chinese Americans are the most angry of all. I don't blame them." I'm assuming he polled Asian Americans to see how mad they are at China or whatever. No, it would be how amazing would it be to live your life where you're like, okay, this thing makes me mad. This thing's going poorly for me. I'm just going to make up whatever I want as a response and tweet it as if it was true. And know that when I make that up, when I provide no evidence for it, 20 to 50,000 people retweet it. They don't care if I had a reason. They, in fact, like that I make things up. What, think about the collective effect that those sorts of interactions over the course of years would have on a human brain, especially one as so severely stunted as Donald Trump. That he is a bad person. He has bad instincts. But his base has made him worse by feeding his worst impulses.
Right. I mean, yeah, this is a guy who it furthered his career with a show where he, you know, fired people famously for, you know, the slightest transgressions or failures or not agreeing with them, things like that. And this is someone who surrounded himself in his business with people of the same mentality. It's like, you know, they're complete and total lackeys. They're supportive, whatever, just a ton of yes men. And that's what he's filled the White House with. And that's what the media, the right wing media and right wing political operatives have positioned themselves, they've positioned themselves similarly. So you have all of these things feeding into that just warped, corrupt mentality. And there's like now a feedback loop where he's getting this, like, these bursts of dopamine for every, like, unhinged thing he tweets out. And that's leading to things like this, which in reality, we're seeing a spike in anti-Asian American racism and acts of racism or harassment in our country because of that kind of stigma that him and other Republican officials are trying to place on China and Chinese Americans. So it's really dangerous underlying all of this stuff because it's leading to real world consequences.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Today, Dr. Anthony Fauci and other health professionals working as part of the coronavirus response team for the federal government have testified before the Senate. And even before it started, we knew that there was going to be some news made that some in government might not like. Before it started, there were headlines like Fauci to warn Senate of needless suffering and death, apparently planning to tell everyone that opening preemptively would be a bad idea. And in fact, that was one of the first things he hit in response to a question. He said, if some areas, cities, states, or what have you jump over those various checkpoints, which he had laid out, and prematurely open up without having the capability of being able to respond effectively and efficiently, my concern is that we will start to see little spikes that might turn into outbreaks. I've been very clear in my message to try to the best extent possible to go by the guidelines, which have been very well thought out and very well delineated. And generally saying that the White House has put out standards supposedly to qualify in an informal sense to reopen. And Trump has decided, no, don't care about that. I'm just going to tell everyone to reopen. It doesn't matter if they're following our guidelines. And in fact, many of the states are not. And we also found out there had been a report put together. It was not released, but it was leaked to NBC News showing that recently in many red states, states that are in the process of reopening or recently have, they are seeing an expansion of coronavirus cases that the White House doesn't want to acknowledge publicly.
Yeah, I saw some data over the weekend that, places, like you said, that have started to reopen, they're starting to see spikes, where places that have had strict social distancing measures, like big cities on the East Coast, are starting to see declines, which is great. But now it's going to spread in the rural areas. And if you have that kind of lackadaisical attitude, you're going to spread in places that would have been otherwise hard to reach. So I really hope people listen to medical professionals and not Trump or Lori Ingram or Tucker Carlson, because this is going to be catastrophic if we then have the spread in areas that, like I said, were otherwise hard to reach, like rural areas, the Midwest, the Great Plains, areas like that. This isn't about freedom or liberty. And you see this, you see the fight over the restaurant in Castle Rock, Colorado, and people showing up with guns and American flag t-shirts and Captain America shields and a 3%er t-shirt, which is incredible. But it's just like they're completely missing the point. Your freedom is not being infringed because you can't get a caramel macchiato like at a cafe. Like you are jeopardizing the health and safety of others around you. And the workers who are probably, possibly being forced into that situation. It's just wait. Just please just wait it out. Just stay at home. if you need it so bad, please just get it delivered. They're completely missing the mark. And a friend of mine pointed out on the sign they were comparing the situation and invoking the names of like Hitler and Stalin.
Oh my god!
So just absolutely warped. And I really hope that place gets shut down.
Yeah, and I wish that more of the American people, those participating in these lockdowns, those who are growing more frustrated with the quarantines and everything, although many of these states have opened up already, would realize the like national level sleight of hand that has been perpetrated on them, mostly due to the fact that they have made the unfortunate decision to trust Fox News for their news, is that they are sitting at home, they are justifiably worried about their economic situation. They're worried that their jobs might not return, that their businesses might go under, that they might not be able to pay rent or for their mortgage. These are all understandable concerns. And the people that they've trusted in the media have said, well, if you are worried about that, and you should be, take it out on your mayor, take it out on your governor, force them to reopen. Pretending that they can't say, hey, Mitch McConnell, maybe pass a bill. Hey, Trump, maybe push for some sort of aid. Maybe $1,200 was not all that the government could do for the American people. But no, they were taught $1,200, that's the limit. Don't expect anything more. Nothing else should come. And even if it does, that would be unconstitutional in some way. It would be infringing on the tree of liberty. Like the government, it's communism, basically. If the government helps us get through this incredibly difficult situation. And it's ridiculous because we know that if Mexico was invading, the conservatives wouldn't be saying, yeah, the government should send us $1,200 and that's it. We can defend ourselves with that. They shouldn't do anything more. But of course, in this situation, that's enough. And because of that, they're supporting reopening that the responsible medical professionals are saying is a bad idea. I really hope that we get through. I hope that there is a miracle. Like right now, I've described it as they are rolling the dice on this thing. Maybe we'll get lucky and it'll come up no big spikes. The last 2 days have been pretty good with numbers of cases and number of deaths largely going down. Yesterday was higher than 2 days ago, but largely have gone down. But now they're doing everything they can. Like if the virus was in charge of the response, it would be saying, just end the lockdowns as fast as you possibly can. And that's what we're doing. Hopefully we won't have an explosion in cases, but we are doing everything we can to maximize the chance that that will happen.
Right. And I think a point that we should consider here is that people are being kind of thrust into the situation unfairly. We talked about it before with the reopen protests, like, people are now in a situation where because there's no rent freezes, because they only got a one-time payment, if you're out of work, and in many states, it's difficult to even get unemployment benefits. I know tons of friends who are really struggling to get on, unemployment compensation or get like loans.
Yeah.
There's just tons of hoops to jump through. This payroll protection thing is making it increasingly difficult. They're being forced into the situation where they have to choose between going back to work or going broke. And that's not fair to them. The answer is, you know, the government steps in and helps, or we have a rent freeze, or both. I would prefer both. So I think we have to acknowledge that the government needs to step in here. It's not risking your liberty or your freedom for them to help you, because, you know, we don't see the same complaints from the right when it comes to giving Ruth's Chris Steakhouse millions of dollars. No one complained on the right when the Lakers got $20 million. And granted, those institutions gave that money back. But that was their first response shows this really isn't about liberty or freedom or anything like that. It's about power and money protecting your own self-interests. And you are never going to be at the front of those considerations. You are not going to be their top concern or priority. So demand more. Be loud. Speak out. Don't go buy coffee at a coffee shop and jeopardize the health and safety of others. Speak out safely and securely from your own home without spreading this virus. And demand more. Hold your elected officials accountable.
Yeah. Yeah, Lamar Alexander said yesterday, we don't have money to help everyone. But we handed trillions of dollars to businesses like that. It was no thought whatsoever. No, you remember the weeks of public debate we had where everyone across the country is weighing in, is this a good idea or not? No, because it didn't happen. They just passed it super fast.
Yep.
But, you know, an extra $750, I mean, we don't worry. What are we, Scrooge McDuck? We can't afford that. And finally, Trump was supposed to be different. Like, that's what his base thinks. He's like a right-wing populist. You know, he appeals to the regular Joe, even though he's a billionaire who literally craps on a golden toilet. And when the people were hurting, both physically in terms of their health and economically, what did he give them? In terms of government response, he gave them effectively what any Republican ever would have. And that's not really our responsibility. We don't want to spend any money. We're not going to do it. We're going to give money to the businesses. We're going to help out rich people. We're going to do that. We don't really care about you. And then just encourages them, uses the power of persuasion that he has, the bully pulpit that he has, to tell them, you should throw yourself willingly into the meat grinder to help out Tyson Foods and, you know, Morgan Stanley and whatever. Like, you should be converted. The working class should be ground up to help the economic elites. That's what the test of right-wing populism has shown us in 2020. It provides the exact same policy outcomes that any Republican would. It's just a little bit more persuasive in getting people to betray their own economic interests. Oh, and also heavy, heavy layering of xenophobia and racism on top of it, by the way. During the Senate testimony today, Bernie Sanders had a couple of really good questions that I want to show you, shed light on a couple of both current concerns and also concerns going forward with the coronavirus. First, here he is asking Dr. Fauci about the current estimates of the number of Americans that have died from this thing.
The official statistic, Dr. Fauci, is that 80,000 Americans have died from the pandemic. There are some epidemiologists who suggest the number may be 50% higher than that. What do you think?
I'm not sure, Senator Sanders, if it's going to be 50% higher, but most of us feel that the number of deaths are likely higher than that number, because given the situation, particularly in New York City, when they were really strapped with a very serious challenge to their healthcare system, that there may have been people who died at home who did have COVID, right, who were not counted as COVID because they never really got to the hospital. So in direct answer to your question, I think you are correct.
Okay. So look, that's what we know to be true. I know that some people believe that they're just counting. Like, if you get hit by a truck, they count it as coronavirus or whatever. I don't understand how people... Well, I do. Fox has said it. That's what some people believe. But no, responsible professionals are saying that it is almost certainly the case, particularly in New York, that it is an undercount. So I'm glad that Bernie Sanders helped to shed some light on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue with not testing everybody. You know, we're going to see this disparity when we're not testing people or only testing people with symptoms, when we know you can be asymptomatic, carry it, and infect other people. I think we're going to see this kind of like recoil from skeptics about these types of counts. But because, you know, it's going to be way, way worse. We should be testing everybody. We should be on top of this. We should be proactive. But sadly, you know, like everything else, it's tainted by conspiracy theories. I saw someone post a viral tweet yesterday that claimed hospitals were getting like 35,000 for every COVID-19 death certificate and things like that. Just like, this is absolutely bogus. We shouldn't be pushing that kind of stuff because it was completely unfounded. But also, the tech platforms need to be way more diligent in policing their platforms for that kind of misinformation. Like, that's absolutely dangerous to have spreading. And there's just like thousands of thousands of retweets, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So Twitter said they're going to have like a label for misinformation about this kind of stuff. But like, we've seen them say things like that before and they really haven't applied it. But they'll take down memes. I've seen them take down memes about different presidential candidates that were like obviously jokes. So, you know, pick your poison, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw that they announced that they're going to do that. They're going to like add like a star or something like that to indicate coronavirus misinformation. And I saw people tweeting that's censorship. They're not even taking it down. They're just accurately labeling that medical professionals don't agree with it. And look, I'm not going to go on for a long time because I'm just going to depress myself. But the volume of misinformation is so bad and it gets so much worse each year. It feels so futile to try to stand in the path of it and just throw your hands out, because not only is there way more of it than your speech could ever match, but it's inherently by the people that it targets spread more actively. These people who love fake news just dwell in it. That's what they do, is they stay online on Twitter all day and they spread it. And the people who spread it make tons of money too, by the way. So it's a great system that we've set up in terms of the spread of information on the internet. Good job, Al Gore. But anyway, let's turn to the future. So we talked there about the number of people who have already died from coronavirus. Let's turn now to the solution, with the solution being, if you talk to literally anyone other than Donald Trump, it's a vaccine. Everybody other than Trump says we need to have a vaccine. So the concern, though, is once a vaccine is made available, is it going to truly be available to everyone, regardless of your economic situation? Here is Bernie Sanders.
At least that everybody in America who needs that vaccine will get it, regardless of their income. Is that a fair assumption?
Senator, I certainly hope so. FDA is very committed to making sure that all populations in the United States, including those most vulnerable, are included in the clinical trials.
And well, that's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, if and when the vaccine comes, it won't do somebody any good if they don't get it. And if they have to pay a sum of money for it in order to profit the drug companies, that will not be helpful. Are you guaranteeing the American people today that that vaccine will be available to all people, regardless of their income?
Sir, the payment of vaccines is not a responsibility of FDA.
Anybody else want to comment on that? Mr. Jarrell, do you think we should make that vaccine when hopefully it is created available to all regardless of income? Or do you think that poor people and working people should be last in line for the vaccine?
My office is one of the offices committed to serving the underserved.
So when you're telling the American people today that regardless of income, every American will be able to gain access to that vaccine when it comes?
They should gain access to it. I don't control,
You represent an administration that makes that decision.
I will certainly advocate that everyone is able to receive the vaccine regardless of income or any other circumstance.
Let me just switch.
Okay, so look, it went on longer, but spoiler alert, none of the people he asked would confirm that it would be made available for free to everyone that needed it.
Yeah, I mean, that's just reflective of our healthcare system in general. That no one was willing to go on the record and say, yeah, absolutely, regardless of class or income or wealth or social situation, anything. That's a red flag. That's why as we globally face this pandemic, and everyone is in the same situation, no matter nationality, ethnicity, race, creed, gender, religion, whatever. Why are we now in a situation where no one's willing to stick their neck out and be like, yeah, everyone should get a vaccine? Mm-hmm. And I think it shows like the power and influence of the pharmaceutical lobby, the for-profit healthcare industry, and why we are so broken compared to every other industrialized country. This is a no-brainer. This is a yes, absolutely easy question to answer. But the fact that it was so difficult to get people to even reach that point where it's like, oh yeah, I'd like to, but it's out of my hands. No. You say you fight tooth and nail to do it because it's the right thing to do. And it really underscores the need for Medicare for all in the United States.
Now, Jordan, you say it's a no-brainer, but what if you held millions of dollars in stock in the company that the government approves to manufacture and distribute the vaccine? Would it be a brainer then?
A little bit tougher then.
Yeah, that's the thing. Unfortunately, it would be. And right now they're considering multiple different potential vaccines made by multiple different companies. At some point, they're going to pull the trigger on one or more of them. Trump and other people in government are going to know what those companies are. So hypothetically, they could purchase stock because we've decided as a country that it's totally cool for our elected representatives to have a financial stake in companies that their legislation and executive orders affect. And so then why would he order that it be free? Why would he use government resources to produce and distribute it? Why would he do that? I mean, look, if he cared about the people, he would do it. If he was the populist he's made out to be, he would do it. But no, he wants the money, and furthermore, he wants everyone else he knows, all the other rich a-holes he knows, to make bank off of this. So I'm glad that Bernie asked the question. I mean, most of the people he was asking of, they probably, like, if it was up to them, they might make it available free, but it's not up to them. And I'm glad that Bernie made clear, if it gets covered, and it probably won't get covered, that no, there are no plans right now to make it available free or potentially even subsidized. It is probably going to end up being expensive, and that means that even once we reach the miraculous result of having a vaccine, you're going to have some chunk of the country that believes that vaccines are a plot hatched between Bill Gates and the devil, and you're going to have a much bigger part of the country that won't be able to afford it, or is going to have to make incredibly difficult financial situations where it's, do I pay my rent or do I get the vaccine for my kids? Do I have food this week or do I have the vaccine for myself and my spouse? That's the sort of decision that they're setting us up for.
Yeah, I mean, it's only going to make things worse, and it's only going to make this kind of social distancing and, you know, augmented commercial situations, they're only going to elongate that. So the greed is going to make the problem worse. The corporate greed, the pharmaceutical greed, the investor greed, it's just only going to make matters worse for us. And you're going to see around the world, people just accept it and distribute it for free or for low cost or make it accessible and available for everybody, regardless of income or class. And, you know, because we're a broken society, we're not going to do that. So a handful of rich pharmaceutical billionaires can get even richer.
Just a few weeks ago, as anti-lockdown protests start to spread through multiple, generally blue states, that's the pattern I noticed, we predicted at the time that because many of these individuals weren't social distancing, they weren't wearing masks, they were crowding into small areas, it is likely that a few weeks after that, we would see cases of coronavirus start to spread amongst those who participated in these protests. And it turns out that there's data indicating that exactly that has happened. 72 individuals who tested positive for COVID-19 in Wisconsin recently attended a, quote, large gathering before their diagnosis. We have a little bit more information from spokesperson Jennifer Miller of the DHS saying, we were able to pull some limited data out of 1,986 cases with onset or diagnosis on or after April 26th. There were 72 cases who reported attending a large gathering. And understand that at some of these big protests, only one third of protesters were said to be wearing masks at the event. Now, Jordan, we can't say definitively that that they got it at the lockdown protest they were at, but considering that other large gatherings weren't happening, and we know that people weren't socially distancing, it seems reasonable to assume that a large chunk of those can probably be attributed to those events.
Yeah, we could absolutely infer that's where it came from, which is sad because, you know, I think for some of those folks, they're thrust into this situation like we talked about earlier, where some people really do need income because they're struggling. I wouldn't say all of them, and I think there's some people who are exploiting this movement for, you know, Second Amendment reasons or things like that, or, you know, we've seen, like we've talked about before, we've seen elements of other groups like the 3%ers showing up and things like that. But there are some people who are duped by this rhetoric and also thrust in the situation because the government is not helping them. And we have Republican officials blocking any aid for these people because, you know, they're there to represent business owners and capitalist interests. So it doesn't actually matter to them that these people are in an unsafe situation, both in the protest or going back to work early. They just want people to get back to work because it helps business owners, it helps the economy, and ultimately helps investors. So people are unfairly put in this situation. So it's kind of sad to see that people who are of those who are at the protest duped into being there because they need help and they need income. It's kind of sad to see them actually get sick and potentially risk their life or the lives of those around them. So unfortunate circumstance. And yeah, like you said, the third weren't wearing masks. So they were not practicing things that everyone should just generally accept, regardless of where you stand on reopening. Even with that reopening, there's going to be like a mask requirement. So they weren't even doing that shows the absolute recklessness of people who attended these things.
Exactly. And we watched at the time, we watched video interviews of some of these individuals. And one of the saddest things was the people who were at the protest saying, I'm immunocompromised, but I have to fight for my rights. I just think, like, you have to fight for your life too, man. Like, seriously, like, this is, it's just so sad to see people, to see the obvious effect of right-wing media's spreading of, from the very beginning, downplaying the coronavirus before it even hit, and then continually downplaying the severity of it, pretending that we have these miracle cures so you don't have to worry about it, pretending that you can't trust the numbers, spreading myths about Bill Gates and 5G and all that stuff. And then to see the actual effect of the people that it's going to have that effect on. Like, Tucker Carlson's not going to get exposed to coronavirus no matter how many BS lies he spreads on a nightly basis. But some guy who has, like, you know, like a respiratory illness, he goes to the protests and he might get it. Those 72 people, maybe one or two of them die. I hope not. But they might. And those are the 72 that have been identified right now in Wisconsin during that period. God only knows with all the protests that have happened. And not just, you know, in other parts, like here in California, in Huntington Beach, there were protests like this. And so I worry that what we predicted at the time is now playing out. And that as these places reopen, I mean, you've probably seen the videos of people like going into supermarkets and yelling at the workers for having to wear a mask. Like, there's the percentage that want things to reopen, and then there's a smaller but not insignificant number who don't want any sort of infringement on their rights. They want to go back 100% to normal. If you're listening to the podcast, I'm very much giving air quotes. They don't want to socially distance. They don't want to wear masks. We're going to see one of the deadly effects of that in just a minute, but it's just sad to see it playing out just as we predicted just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it really shows that people just don't care about the working class or the poor. People who absolutely need economic relief now, like real substantive relief, whether it's through unemployment benefits or stimulus checks, anything like that, or rent relief, people need help. And that the fury is directed toward, like you said, people in grocery stores wearing masks or other workers or things like that. It's just, it's heartbreaking because people who, like I said earlier, people who are duped into going to these types of things because they need help are ultimately going to suffer even more. So my heart goes out to them a little bit more than other people who are at those protests. But it's unfortunate that this is being spread. And, you know, like we talked about earlier, in some places reaching areas like rural areas where it would have otherwise been hard to reach.
Exactly.
So sad all around.
Yeah. And we're going to have to, you know, I'm watching every day, like we're getting towards where some of these reopenings would have had that 2-week sort of period for things to build up. It's going to take a little bit of time, but I am watching and fingers crossed, hoping that, you know, the people at the very bottom aren't going to be lethally affected by the misinformation that they've been sold. News out of the UK, a rail worker who was assaulted by an individual who apparently had coronavirus, has passed away as a result of that. Let me give you some of the details. The woman's name is Belly Mohinga. She was working with a colleague when a member of the public assaulted them, spat and coughed over them, and said that he had the novel coronavirus, according to the Transport Salaried Staffs Association. That's the union for those UK rail workers. She died on April 5th, 14 days after she was assaulted at the Victoria Station. She leaves behind an 11-year-old daughter and a husband who last saw her when she was taken away by ambulance. So just briefly, obviously, absolutely horrendous. We've seen cases of this before. Like, I saw a video of a supermarket where a guy who had been yelling at people who work there wiped his nose on one of their shirts. Like people who don't take this seriously think that it's a joke and then do things that can potentially kill someone. This individual did die. It is going to get worse in another way in just a second. But Jordan, I want to give you an opportunity to chime in.
This is heartbreaking. This is someone who should have had, you know, way more protections, way more protective equipment. Possibly, it's tough when you have infrastructure like railways that, you know, there needs to be some limited service. But, you know, absolutely should have been protected, totally preventable. And what an, I don't know, actually I can't say that word, but what a jerk for the person who, just absolute psychopath, that ultimately took someone else's life because of just negligence and just absolute disregard for someone else's life. Terrible. I mean, this is just, you know, for her and her union and her coworkers and everyone around the world, I mean, the workers of the world need to unite because this is just totally preventable.
Exactly. Yeah, the individual who like has been fed lies about how lethal this thing is, and so is joking, spitting and coughing, and like you might have in your trips out, I'm talking to the audience, you might have come across people like this, think it's funny to joke about and all of that. It's like a person has been convinced that knives aren't dangerous, and so just goes around like waving a knife because like, hey, everyone on news who wears ties and suits, they tell me that knives aren't actually that dangerous, that being stabbed actually isn't as fatal as, you know, the UN tells me. That's like what we're dealing with here. And so this individual died But while the person who spat on them is obviously to blame here, not the only person to blame. As Jordan alluded to, this is another case where an employee was mistreated by their workplace and should have been protected but wasn't. So we have a statement from the union saying, Belli and her colleague begged to be let to work from inside the building with a protective barrier between them and the public for the rest of that day. Management said they needed people working outside and sent them back out onto the concourse for the rest of their shift. Both women went back outside and completed their shift, but they had no personal protective equipment. Belli in particular had underlying respiratory conditions that made her more vulnerable to the coronavirus, and the union is saying that the workplace was fully aware of that and still forced them to go out and work. And this reminds me of the stories we've been talking about the meatpacking plants, of people being forced to work at threat of losing their job, being put into conditions where they were working, you know, elbow to elbow with other people, no personal protective equipment. At one particular Tyson plant, over 1,000 people got coronavirus at one plant. And it's because people didn't take it seriously. And the most important people who are not taking it seriously are those who control the destinies of these workers. It's a problem in the UK, and it's a problem here in the US as well.
Yeah, there's capitalists and business owners typically do not care about the health and safety of workers, because, you know, at the end of the day, they're disposable. They're just cogs in a machine for the business owners and the investors to get rich. Their lives are disposable. They're replaceable. And this is an example of that, you know, pretty modest requests for personal safety were ignored. And now someone is dead as a result of it. So, again, they were organized, but demand more, demand better, always supportive of strikes in this effort. Just don't put yourself in an unsafe situation. But on top of that, and I realize this is a different situation because it's the UK, but especially here, the government has to step in to fill the void. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, corporate influence and capitalist influence has such a grip on American politics, that's one of the roadblocks. That's one of the impediments to actually getting relief.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, people on both parties in Congress are ultimately standing to get richer. Their investments are at stake. We saw insider trading at the onset of this crisis. It's truly a grim situation where human suffering is seen as an opportunity for profit.
100%. And, you know, there's a great example of that. In Texas right now, there's that salon owner who just opened the salon even though they weren't supposed to. And that just doing that made them a right-wing hero for the rest of their life. Like Ted Cruz went and got his haircut there. They're talking about it on Fox News constantly. They talked about it way more than the Arbery case. Another story out of Texas is one restaurant group there in reopening messaged its workers and said, you are not to wear masks, presumably because it sends the wrong signal about how safe it is there. That was not a huge story on Fox. But that is like a decision to try to maximize profit, and I think a wrong one. I don't think it will work, knowing that it puts your workers at risk of getting sick and dying. And that's just the norm. Like, across the country, you are going to have to hope, once the local and the state ordinances pass, you're going to have to hope that the person who signs your paycheck takes it seriously. Because if they don't, you could lose your job, you could lose your home or your apartment, you could also lose your life. That's a system that we've set up. And the people in charge aren't going to challenge it.
Do they wear hats or hair masks if they're in the kitchen?
I don't know.
I'm just saying, if that's, I would argue that that's a responsible thing to do. So if you're taking that step but not a mask, there's just some cognitive dissonance happening there that ultimately is because of, you know, what you talked about earlier, the right-wing influence.
Elon Musk has not necessarily taken the coronavirus seriously from the beginning, but he is serious now, serious about selling cars. And so he tweeted yesterday, Tesla is restarting production today against Alameda County rules. He says rules. I don't think it's just a rule. I think it's kind of a law. But anyway, I will be on the line with everyone else. If anyone is arrested, I ask that it only be me. What a hero. He's such a hero.
Wow.
But anyway, and apparently it's happened. The parking lots were full. I would love to talk. If you're an employee at Tesla, feel free to contact me. I'd love to talk to you about and get your feelings about this. But Jordan, yeah, no, Tesla's full steam ahead. Well, not steam, but full electrons ahead.
That's amazing. The American dream, where your boss can make you go into work in unsafe situations so he can get arrested for a photo op in a situation where he would never suffer. Quite the guy. And really, we talked about this earlier. This ultimately boils down to profit, because if you're familiar with Tesla's history and their production capacity throughout history, they have had notorious production bottlenecks and delays. John, you mentioned before we started the show that the Tesla 3 was delayed up to a year for people on the wait list. So it's not really like they need to get things out immediately, because throughout their history, they've had long delays. So for the safety of employees, that doesn't actually impact anything. They're fine putting employees into unsafe situations to continue this snail pace of production. Ultimately pretty tragic, and I hope everyone there is okay and safe, and I hope they're practicing social distancing measures in that factory and things like that. Ultimately, I hope they don't have to go back to work until things are rectified.
Yeah.
But for him to be like, oh, I asked, it's only going to be me that gets arrested. Like we talked about before we started the show, it just doesn't really impact him, because what's going to be a fine, you know, to a multi-billionaire, that doesn't matter. That's like, you know, fines for those types of things, if you're rich, just means it's, you know, it's free. It's legal if you're rich, because you can afford it.
Exactly.
So it's a photo op ultimately. It's going to look like he's the hero if he gets arrested. So, you know, absolute cynical ploy by Elon Musk just to protect his bottom line.
Exactly. Yeah. He'll have a photo taken. He'll think it's cool. He'll go on Joe Rogan and talk about it. It won't matter to him. It won't have any effect. No. And by the way, another thing to undercut the obvious fake argument from the right wing, that what they want to reopen for is because they just care about how much this is hurting the working class and they won't do anything to actually help them directly. But they want to reopen for that reason. Okay, so he wants to reopen the factory, and that's good then, right? For those workers. He's also threatening that if he's not allowed to, he's going to move Tesla out of California. Presumably meaning that everyone that works there, if they're offered their job, they'll have to move across the country, but the vast majority won't be able to and won't be offered a job. So they're going to lose those jobs. And I forget exactly which state, but there's a Republican governor, one of the East Coast, like the Southern East Coast states, was like, no, you should come here. We have great working environment, low regulation. But you guys are saying that what you care about is the workers, and you're telling him to leave and fire all of those people. How shallow. Like, you poke that argument just a little bit and it breaks through. It's so shallow. But anyway, the bigger issue right now is that Elon Musk, who is a genius, by the way, genius doesn't necessarily apply in this area that much, because he's had a few issues since the beginning of this. Tweeting on March 6th, the coronavirus panic is dumb. Yeah, he's right. It was only like 80,000 and growing. It's dumb. Mm-hmm. It's dumb. And also saying in March 19th, this is 13 days later, he'd learned things. Based on current trends, probably close to zero new cases in US too by end of April. I ran some statistical models and it turns out he was wrong.
Huh.
But he is a genius. Yeah. And here's the thing. Yes, he's smart. He made some cool cars. He made a rocket. It's awesome. Well, I'll say lots of other people and engineers also made those too. It wasn't just him. That doesn't mean he's smart in literally every way. This is not the MCU. That's not how smart works. It doesn't mean that you're right about everything. But there are people that worship this guy as infallible.
It's really bizarre. The cult of personality around him is really bizarre, because it completely ignores like how he had a huge jump start on everyone else because of like his dad's wealth. It's really bizarre for people to rally around him just because he didn't really come up with anything new. He just moved like pre-existing institutions into the digital world, which, you know, being the first person there is a good move, but it like, you didn't actually create anything new. You just like digitized something. So the infrastructure within that really was like for the engineers and the people who produced it and the programmed it and all those types of things. He kind of just had the startup capital. So, I don't really get the fanfare, and when he I can't even say that, but when he shows his true colors here, mm-hmm. It really demonstrates like the bizarre cult of personality around him.
Yeah, and I'm sure everyone has seen a million times the Simpsons meme of justifiable criticism against Elon Musk, and then weird nerds jumping in front of it. He's a guy. He makes good cars. They're cool. If he ever gets his tunnels off the ground, that would be great. I was excited about the Hyperloop. I just wish he would be like excited about an idea for more than like a week and a half. But anyway, no, I don't take away any of what he's actually done. But that does not mean that he is right or smart or rational or sane about everything. And so when it comes to areas like this that he has no training in and apparently is a slow learner, just don't take your advice about these sorts of things from him. And unfortunately, many people will, because not long ago, a few days ago, I think, he was on, I don't know the exact date, you can look it up, but he was on Joe Rogan's show, and he was just willfully spreading coronavirus misinformation again. Maybe he knows that it's wrong, but it's convenient to him because he wants Donald Trump to like him. Donald Trump tweeted favorably about him reopening the plant. I don't know. Or maybe he just doesn't understand, but he gave to an audience of millions of people information that could make them sick and that could potentially kill them.
Yeah, it's super dangerous. I think Media Matters did a really good rundown of all the misinformation in that conversation. So if you head over to their site, it's on there. But also, like, didn't he just have a kid? Like, dude, go be with your kid. Go on paternity leave for like a week. Just chill out. Really, I don't know. He can't log off. He can't just take a break. He's got something going on where he just like has to be in the middle of everything and causing controversy.
Yeah, I saw someone had tweeted like, dude, I know dealing with a newborn's tough, but this is an extreme, like going back to work, like against the law. Thrilled to welcome back to the program, Michael Brooks. How's it doing, man?
Hey, man, it's great to be talking with you. And, you know, not the best of times, but no. Definitely we're, you know, can't complain, obviously, but yeah, doing fine. Yeah. How are you doing?
Well, one thing that makes it easier is being able to talk to people you respect and admire. And thankfully, due to the power of the internet, we're able to do that. So
yes, very my glad, honor, man. Thank you.
Very glad to have you back on. Obviously, if people are not familiar, host of the Michael Brooks Show, friend of this show, and also author, no big deal, but Against the Web, the Cosmopolitan Socialist Answer to the New Right. By the way, it's out. It's available. You can read it. We're going to be talking about it. I went to read the blurb on Amazon because I was told by one of my producers that it was written by Anna Kasparian. And as I was reading that, I noticed, no big deal, but that your book was number one new release in political philosophy.
Which is cool. I mean, you know, who knows how many people are buying political philosophy books. But I will say one of the things that feels good about that is I'm telling everybody, and I should say the working title was Cosmopolitan Socialist Answer, and they went with just Cosmopolitan, got rid of the socialist. So in case you're looking it up, but I've been telling everybody to buy it at Red Emma's in Baltimore, which is a great worker cooperative owned bookstore. And I have a friend of mine over there who works there, and it's nice little shot in the arm during these times that people are ordering it from there. So I've been saying, don't buy it at Amazon if it can be possibly avoided. So the fact that that's still doing well at Amazon, that's a nice signal, man. I think some people are buying it.
Exactly. Yeah, that should go without saying. I just like that Anna's thing was listed there.
Oh, totally.
But I want to talk to you about the book because you delve into and lay out concise but all-encompassing arguments against the intellectual dark web. Prepping for this interview, I once again read part of the Barry Weiss Meet the Renegades of the Intellectual Dark Web article, and I was reminded that that is possibly the most embarrassing thing I've ever read on the New York Times. But anyway, tell me
about a competition.
That's true. But this is pretty bad. So why the intellectual dark web?
Well, at the time in 2018, when I got asked to write the book, and definitely like the kind of brand has dissipated. And I think fortunately, the book has a bigger argument about actually really like the nature of the left and how it could be better that transcends dealing with this particular group. But, you know, in 2018, they had a lot of traction, particularly in the world that we're in. I felt like they were sort of migrating people into politics that I didn't, you know, necessarily agree with. But I also thought they were exploiting a lot of weaknesses that we could do better on, the left could do better on. And, you know, what really got me about them as a group, honestly, was not every this or that position that they had or thinking that everything they said was necessarily illegitimate, but just the totally ahistorical nature of all of it. And to me, I really, really think, and I think it's a big problem like across the board, that if we don't start to have a historical framework for understanding things, whether it's why does the United States not have single payer and other comparable countries have national health care, or how does our foreign policy relate to Islam as an example, or even why do we have such unprecedented alienation and inequality in some ways in the economy? What is that about? Like, what were the actual forces driving it? And I think that's also, by the way, some people complain. They say, like, these aren't right-wing guys because, you know, Sam Harris doesn't like Donald Trump or whatever. That wasn't the point. And my view is that any right-wing project is a project that looks at the world as it is and basically says there's, like, immutable laws that make it so, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's scientific truths or mythological truths, that explain to you why things are as they are. And then they use a lot of, like, disanalogies to naturalize things. Like, whoa, you want to get rid of, like, extreme income inequality and profound imbalances in power between capital and labor? Well, I guess you think that kids should be able to, you know, set their own bedtimes, or you want every NBA team to win the playoffs or every football team to get a ring. No. We make obvious distinctions here. And in fact, we want a society where we can enjoy competition and enjoy different outcomes that just aren't spilling over into whether or not people's, like, life expectancies are decreased, as an example.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so you talk about the need for us to understand our history, to understand the situation we're in, and presumably to figure out fixes to get to where we want to be. They in their arguments will say that they care about history, that they're hearkening back to some sort of mythic idea of what the United States was and should be again. Certainly Donald Trump and his rhetoric, he makes you think that that is what he's doing. But not to spoil some of what you reveal in the book, and I understand that everyone is going to say this about their political or philosophical rivals, but they don't strike me as people who actually care if what they're saying is true for the most part. Very often, like, Dave Rubin doesn't seem to care if he's accurately reflecting the present, let alone the past. You know, they have people on like Dinesh D'Souza, who, you know, like what he says about the KKK and the Civil War, like, it's so divorced from reality. So does that, like, obviously didn't deter you from writing the book, but when you are putting out a historically grounded case designed to persuade against people who seem to be wholly unconcerned about whether what they're saying is factual or not, how does that affect the way that you try to make your case and potentially to appeal to people who haven't chosen sides?
Well, I will warn people that I don't spend that much time talking about Dave Rubin in the book. I mean, I have a little bit of fun with him, and, you know, he's fun to make fun of and whatever, but I try to take on
More intellectually serious members of the IDW.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you think of them. And I'm sure that Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris think that they are being very precise. And I actually, that's one thing I would not take from them. I think that it is sincere. I mean, obviously, I have fundamental structural disagreements, but I think that they have very sincerely held worldviews. You know, Dave, I honestly just can't comment on. I don't even know if he understands what worldview means. But I think that, you know, what is always interesting to me, and it's funny because I think we've sort of overlearned some of the lessons of electoral politics, which is that this obsession with swing voters is not a great way to understand how to build a successful and effective campaign and put forward, you know, economic populist policy or make the case for civil rights or whatever. And I think that's true. But I actually think that in a funny way, when you're in media, you actually do need to be much more attentive to that, which is, what are the group of people who, they could come from a variety of different backgrounds, have different tendencies, but they are responding to style, they're responding to presentation, and they're also responding to ways of how you make your argument. So I was sort of hoping, you know, with the book, is that if people are, I mean, I think, you know, some people are going to obviously, you know, plenty of people are buying it who already, you know, like the work I do. They're probably sympathetic to this. And I think what the book does, hopefully, is this idea of cosmopolitan socialism is a different spin on how to frame left-wing politics, which I think is effective and interesting, hopefully, for people. Mm-hmm. But I think for people who are outside of it, and I do get, you know, and I do interviews and talk to people who are not necessarily like IDW people or whatever, but they're definitely not on the left. They might really have sympathy for some of these people. And when they see how I'm putting together arguments, and it's not just, you know, somebody saying like, oh, you like these guys, you're a bad person, or, you know, this person said X, Y, and Z, and that's problematic and blah, 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 blah. They actually are like, whoa, you actually do probably seem like you have a pretty good grasp on this stuff. And maybe I have to actually really rethink how this information is being presented to me. And it's funny because on the history thing, I don't, you know, I don't know about Dinesh, you know, I didn't, Dinesh D'Souza, I'm sure, has probably been on Rubin's show, I would imagine. But the only one of them that really talks, I mean, Peterson talks about the West as some type of, you know, kind of philosophical concept, which is really shaky. But, you know, Ben Shapiro, who really is just a standard right-wing talk show host, in my opinion, and the fact that he's part of this scene says a lot. But his book is supposedly this historical rendering of Western society and this marriage of Athens and Jerusalem. And I got to tell you, if you're going to say that there's an uninterrupted Western history that connects Greek and Hebraic thought, it's a pretty big problem. And forget, you know, being PC. I'm talking like doing your work and checking your notes to skip Islamic history. You know, like that just isn't going to work.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's definitely, I mean, it's hard not to see an ideological motivation in that.
Yeah, definitely. And a financial one, of right. course, because they're quite successful, both in their own right. But also, you know, this steps a little bit away from the particular topic that you're covering in the book, but you host a show and you've written a book, it was very well received. I host a show. We have this like ecosystem of these sorts of this sort of content. The right has that too, and the rise of the IDW sort of went along with the rise of the success of conservatives on YouTube and things like that, and certainly they're writing books and selling them too. Along the way, though, it seems like there has been a lot of institutional and elite support for one side of that in terms of bulk buys of books and huge investments in media companies and things like that. I don't know of anything like that on the left. Does it matter? Are we missing out much on that? Would it be nice to have something supporting us? Like, for instance, I know Ben Shapiro's show, the advertising it receives on Facebook is in the like the millions of dollars a year range, which is something, it seems like. What do you think about that, about the difference in outside support for these competing ecosystems?
Well, I think three quick things. I think sometimes, honestly, like, look, it's 100% right. And it's sort of, it's baked into the cake. I think sometimes the left has used that absolutely correct take to not look at how we can be better and more appealing in some ways, which I don't want to, you know, I think it's important to not use it like that. On the other hand, I think, look, there, especially if you're doing any type of, say, like labor-oriented, like anywhere from like genuinely progressive, let alone like kind of Marxist content, right? I mean, there is a structural contradiction between venture capital being interested in producing that kind of work, right? And yeah. And literally the content. So I think that that's part of the playing field. And I think, you know, that's obviously reflected in politics. You have mega donors that will support, like, you know, a white identitarian politics party that supports oligarch policies with the Republicans. And then it will support Democrats who, you know, may have a certain superficial commitment to some aspects of, you know, representation of diversity, some of which, you know, on a legal level are extremely important. But have no, you know, don't want to do anything structural about, you know, just mass inequality and mass disparity. And so I think that that's going to be something we always run up against, that you can. And it's also interesting to me, too, that I don't think necessarily, like, I think that I don't, you know, people like us, I don't think would be candidates, frankly, for funding from those sources regardless. But it's interesting to me that when you read about Republican funders versus Democratic mega funders, the Republican funders are actually a lot more generous and a lot more strategic and seem to be much less ego driven. Like, you know, you have like Bloomberg and Steyer have basically just kind of like completely defanged the environmental movement, in my estimation, kind of return, you know, basically like just sort of like giant clubs for their funding. And that's, I think, undermined the efficacy of some environmental organizations. And then you think of like, just, you know, like Steyer running for president, right? Like, why? You know, like what, like why is like what is his self-expression so important? And then like the, you know, the evil Kochs. Yeah, the guy did a silly run in 1980, but they have spent decades slowly and methodically just seeding people and seeding organizations and really taking a long-term view. And it's interesting that there's more capacity to do that on the right than in the center in terms of oligarchs. But I just think at the end of the day, if your politics really comes down to like, yeah, you shouldn't be a billionaire. I don't care how nice guy you are, or if you tested well, or if you were at the right place at the right time. And I'm not even saying you shouldn't have, you know, sure, you can have a nice life or whatever, and sure, but that level of wealth and influence is never going to be compatible with democracy. And I'm not totally sure why they would be stoked to fund that message, you know.
Yeah, even the individuals who might be like, oh, when I die I'm giving it all away, that's later. Right now, oh, yeah. I want to keep it. Okay, so moving to solutions, obviously that's the book. We don't want to spoil that. We want people to go and take a look at the book. But what's one thing that we can do to be better, both as individuals, someone watching this video maybe, who's following this content, who's, you know, arguing online, engaging with politics, or me, I host a show. What can I do to be a little bit better?
Wow. I mean, Jesus, I don't know, a little bit better. I don't know about all that. I would say that we have to really, what concerns me sometimes right now, and definitely with like a lot of liberal politics, when they talk about, you know, like the Trump voters or whatever, sometimes there is a tendency to recreate bad ideas and bad ways of doing things from the past. So I'll just say this. I remember kind of coming into politics in some ways after and around the time of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And this was a time in the country where it would, you know, anybody could be able to understand that obviously that action was a crime against humanity and a travesty. And also that we needed to understand what had led up to it ideologically, politically, historically, and so on. And the mainstream reactionary view from all of the corporate press and from all Republicans and a vast majority of Democrats was that to even have that conversation somehow yeah. validated the terrorists. And I got to say, in a much different way, like, I'm sorry, just saying that Jordan Peterson is wrong all day isn't going to do anything. What are the needs he's speaking to? What are the problems that he's addressing? I disagree vehemently with, obviously, a lot of his frameworks and solutions, but to pretend that he isn't speaking to real and valid things is strategically disastrous. And actually the moralism of it starts to remind me of, you know, George W. Bush kind of stuff. So I think that we should recognize that understanding the why of something is not a justification for it. And in fact, it's the only way of beginning to address it. And that requires some sophistication and some empathy.
I agree. Man, I immediately start to think of, you know, what do we insert as an alternative? And it's complicated because some of what I see as, like, when you look at the sort of people that have become popular, what are they advertising as? This is why you should follow me, or this is why you should be part of the movement. I certainly agree that there are those needs. Some of the stuff that they offer, though, like, the elevation of trolling over the past few right. years as like the end in politics, obviously it's a distraction, they're confirming judges and giving tax breaks and things like that, but that's the bread and circuses and all of that is identifying groups that I don't like and making them feel bad, and that is what politics should deliver. Whew, man, it's difficult to think about. But anyway, I'm glad that there are people like you doing that
thing. I mean, I appreciate it. And again, I'd even distinguish, like, I actually think when we start to make these distinctions, we can actually get much clearer about some of the stuff that does just need to be, you know, torn apart or honestly made irrelevant mm-hmm. by the right kind of approach. But I mean, of course, I agree with you. I think that yeah. obviously that stuff is disgusting. Yeah. But how we feed it or don't feed it and deal with it is another set of questions.
I agree. And I assume in further books will be delved into even further. But for right now, what is available is Against the Web, available in a variety of places, both online places that you probably should not get it from, and also better places that you should. But Michael, we need warriors, and I'm glad that you're one of them out there fighting this battle, both every day in your show, but also in the books. Everybody, take a look at that.
Thank you so much, man. Really appreciate it. Stay safe.
You too. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.